Welcome back to the Konya History Club. We're happy you could join us again. Grab a seat, grab a drink, and let's get this meeting started. I'm Camille, and this is Ben, and today we'll be continuing The Horrors of History, our Halloween special. Tonight, we'll be talking about the Chinese massacres and the Jabido massacre. Let's get this meeting started. Let's begin the story of the Jabido massacre. In September, Major Abdul Latif Martelino, otherwise known as Major Eddie Martelino of the Philippine Air Force, arrived in Jolo, blended into the Muslim community, and started recruiting the Muslim youth. Major Martelino had been in the graces of power for years, even before such event. During that time, though, he was Mr. Marcos's top political double agent. According to Senator Aquino, he got himself to head the Marcos Special Forces. This was because he had a skill, apparently, in developing the minority groups like the Ilonggots and the Dumagats. So, Major Martelino went into massive recruitment of Tausug young men, ages 18 to 30, in the islands of the Sulu Archipelago, in September, October, November, and December of 1967. He then recruited those with a working knowledge of the Tausug dialect, with experience in smuggling and kumpit sailing, with familiarity of the neighboring islands, with pleasing personality, and preferably with high school or college education. And to entice the youth to join, he promised them that they would be integrated into the armed forces as paratroopers, as the elite nucleus of a new strike force under the personal command and direction of President Marcos, after a six-month crash training. And, to get the Tausug elders to back him up, he promised to distribute lands to the faithful once his special secret mission had been accomplished and he had proclaimed himself Sultan of the Liberated Territory. So, Major Martelino set up a secret training camp on Simunul Island, later another one in Corregidor. When late Senator Aquino went to inspect the Simunul camp, however, it was deserted. He was told that the Simunul Special Forces Group had been shipped out, destination unknown, mission undisclosed. On Simunul Island, Senator Aquino also saw the recruiting base for a special forces unit called Jabida, and their camp, Camp Sofia, named after the wife of the commanding officer of the Jabidas, Major Martelino himself. Camp Sofia was the recruiting station for the Jabidas. The camp was located inside a coconut plantation off the beaten track, fenced in by some 6 strands of barbed wire. Watchtowers were built all along the perimeter line. The boys there, the late senator noted, were trapped by a bizarre plan and an even more bizarre mission. They were given unorthodox uniforms and brand new carbines and Thompson machine guns. The recruits were told that they would form the nucleus of a special force, and they were tasked to spearhead a mission to end all missions. Sign language was the medium of communications. Sinister-looking patches and rings with encrusted skull and crossbones were their distinguishing marks, the marks of their esprit de corps. The boys were taught how to survive in the jungles without food and clothing. They called this survival training. Although secrecy was supposed to be the hallmark of the organization, and regular PC troopers assigned in Sulu were told to keep off the Jabida area, really, it was all for show. Everyone in the Sulu Isles knew exactly what was going on inside Camp Sofia. Major Martelino, after 2 drinks, spoke freely of his grand plan to liberate an area with his Jabidas, and he always, always boasted that the faithful would be rewarded with free land. The camps were made of makeshift twigs, and the bunks were made of ipil-ipil to simulate living conditions in the jungle, and the recruits were divided into 2 groups, called the Subangan and the Sadlupan groups. These are Tausug words for north and south. Now, by December 30, the number of recruits had increased to some 135, and they were told to board a Philippine Navy vessel to be ferried away to their new camp on Corregidor Island, arriving there on January 3. On the island was an old Corregidor hospital, and it was there that the Jabidas were to stay inside the bombed-out hospital for the remainder of their training. The early days of the recruits on Corregidor proved thrilling, the boys writing to their parents back in Sulu excited, looking forward to the day when they would be inducted as regular Philippine Army troopers. Jungle training of the special forces continued, and the boys marched into the Corregidor jungles for weeks on survival training. But towards the fourth week of February, they started becoming restless. Since their arrival in Corregidor, they had not been paid their allowance of 50 pesos a month. Some of the married recruits wanted to send money to their folks in Sulu. So, on February 25 or 26, the recruits, mostly from the Tawi-Tawi area, signed a petition addressed to President Marcos, demanding their delayed pay of 2 months and an improvement in their living quarters, food, and clothing. They coupled this petition with a prayer that the president visit them. After all, they were supposed to be his own personal special forces. To their dismay, however, it was not Mr. Marcos who arrived, but rather Major Martelino. He told the boys that their pay was coming and called for the four Muslim leaders of the petition, and he allegedly told them that they could go home ahead of the other boys who had petitioned President Marcos. The four leaders were brought to Manila and never returned to Corregidor. Suspicion that the four had been killed grew and gained momentum. Out of the 135 who came to Simunul, 62 signed the petition. Of the 62, a total of 58 remained in camp as of March 1, and they were considered resigned. Then, 24 of their own brothers were taken out. Again, they did not return. Another 12 recruits were told to prepare for home and were never heard from again. Then, another batch of 12 recruits were transported and never heard from. Jibin Arula, in his sworn statement, said that upon reaching the airstrip, they were told to get off their weapons carrier. They were told to form a line, and they were now in civilian clothes and unarmed, while their escorts carried armalites, automatic carbines, and other special forces weapons. During an interview, Arula recounts the fateful day, to quote, "We went to the airport on a weapons carrier truck, accompanied by 13 trainees armed with M16 and carbines. When we reached the airport, our escorts alighted ahead of us. Then, Lieutenant Nepomuceno ordered us to get down from the truck and line up. As we put down our bags, I heard a series of shots. Like dominoes, my colleagues fell. I got scared. I ran away and was shot at. I didn't know that I was running towards a mountain. By 8 a.m., I was rescued by two fishermen on Caballo Island near Cavite." To this date, there have been much debate as to whether such massacre happened, as there are scarce resources regarding the incident, not to mention the veil of political maneuvers that shroud the whole affair. In fact, the late Senator Aquino spoke of the Jabida massacre, expose in the Senate, expressed doubt that Moro trainees were killed. But before jumping to conclusions, we should note that although Senator Aquino did say he had reservations as to the existence of a massacre that occurred on the island, he does say that although the army asserts that the recruits are alive, if the army cannot produce them, the question remains, what happened to them? They, the army authorities, will have to stand the accusation of murder and maybe even mass slaughter. To quote, "The fact is, there must have been, or there could have been, killings. Maybe, I will even submit, some of the companions of Arula could have been shot. Only a fair investigation will bring out the facts." By the asserted mass massacre of 60, we can now safely say that the figure has been reduced by 29. But what of the other 31 men? If they are indeed alive, where are they? No answer arises due to the facts stated earlier, and due to the minimal, if any, efforts to look for them. The year 2020 marks the 52nd year of the Jabida massacre, yet the Filipino people are no closer to knowing the truth.
It's interesting kasi both of our stories for tonight, yung massacres, they're politically motivated.
Wow.
It's very telling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think ano eh, massacres don't, it's not something that just a regular person can go off and do, you know? Like, you have to have resources, people to do it for you. Like, you can't just do it on a whim. It's usually, like, charged with political, ano eh, political ambition, no?
Yeah, there should be, like, a concerted effort talaga to kill that great of amount of people.
And, honestly, like, I was thinking, parang, it's a whole new level of evil. Because you purposefully gather people to kill for you, and it's premeditated, as in, like, at least maybe like a week or a month before it happens. Now you've already set your mind na, oh, we have to do this, and these are the people that we have to target. You know, like, I don't think it's something you can do on a whim na parang trip trip mo lang, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I don't know. I just hope we, you know, we justice is attained somehow. Like, but it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to be hopeful, especially when it's, you know, like you said, it's politically charged. Because, you know, when people in power are the ones who did the deed, you know, it's hard to find evidence and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, parang what's going on in my mind right now is parang what, like, how do you get to that point where you decide whether you should massacre people or not?
Yeah, it's surreal, no? Parang, I don't know, what kind of state of mind you have to be in to just, like, wake up one day and parang decision-making time, and you think na, oh, okay, it's time to kill like 30 people.
Parang I want to see yung how the events unfold wherein you put yourself into that position na magde-decide ka.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get there?
Yeah, like yung thought process na parang, like, okay, so I have to do A, B, and C, but to get to A, I have to kill 30 people. Like, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. Like, I don't know. Like, the amount of mental gymnastics you have to do just to justify in your, parang, I don't know. Like, would you even feel bad about it? Like, I mean, not you, but like in general, like the person who decides to massacre a group of people, because I feel like they would have already parang justified it in their mind na, mm-hmm, I have to do this, parang, and that's the sad thing is parang at the end of the day, because of so much justification, parang they don't even feel bad about it anymore, because if they doubt what they're saying, parang they would, like, the guilt would just consume them. So parang you can't let yourself feel guilty for even a second, kasi, you know, it would be like admitting na mali yung ginawa mo, right? And of course, hindi nila gagawin yan.
Exactly. Yun, kaya nga yung mga politicians natin, eh, you know, makakapal yung mga mukha.
Yeah. And I don't know, like, once you're that far gone, like, I don't think there's even, I don't know, is there even a redemption, I don't know, like a point of redemption? I don't think so. I was thinking, parang when you dig yourself so far into this hole, parang, you know, they try to dig themselves out of it, pero at the end of the day, they just go in deeper and deeper and deeper until hindi na nila kilala yung sarili nila. Like, when I have to wonder, like, if they look at themselves in the mirror, is it still the same person as, you know, like, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? And I guess it's just scary na, And yeah, like I said, it's surreal that na there are people who make these kinds of decisions as if ulam lang siya, like as if you're just deciding kung ano yung ulam mo for the day. Well, maybe that's minimizing their decision making naman, but I don't know, like yeah, it's just surreal for me. And yeah.
Now we're going to Chinese massacres with an S. They all happened within the same century, 1600s. And, you know, we're going to explore that. And we're going to discuss bakit siya naging politically motivated. So, yung maging main reference natin for tonight is a paper. A paper about the massacre of 1603, aka the first massacre. The first Chinese massacre in the Philippines. And so yeah, it's entitled The Massacre of 1603, Chinese Perception of the Spaniards in the Philippines by Jose Eugenio Borao of National Taiwan University. So it's a Chinese account.
Mm-hmm.
And well, according to this paper, mas extensive rin naman talaga yung accounts ng Chinese. Like they have more official accounts of how it transpired. Like they, meron silang like day by day accounts of what actually happened, whereas yung historians natin like si Morga, yung mga Chinese chroniclers natin, they have a more like digestible, like summarized version, and according to some historians, more biased yung, like not really biased, I mean yes it's biased, but they were trying to justify how it happened in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yung sa Spanish chroniclers. Whereas yung Chinese, allegedly, they are more objective in retelling the story. So, Chinese massacre and how it came to be. And, well, it really came to be as how history transpired. Like in this era, as the Spanish would justify, there was a rampant increase of piracy in Chinese waters. You know, in the 1500s and 1600s, there was an express prohibition that Chinese subjects engage in maritime commerce at a time when it was gaining popularity in the international arena. So yes, around that time, sobrang daming maritime trade, like around Asia, around Europe, yun nga yung Acapulco galleon trade sa Philippines mismo. So around the world, there was like a boom of maritime commerce, and at this period, the Chinese, they were prohibiting this type of trade. So of course there was a rampant increase of piracy, and Because of this prohibition, a lot of Chinese were seeking alternatives and other profitable solutions. And also at this time, Manila was considered an important center for the export of silver in Southeast Asia, as well as other exports rin naman. I mean, Manila was like a center point for trade. So 1600s, we had a big, very big Chinese community, as in hindi siya Chinese Filipino. Parang wala pa talagang masyadong concept of like a Chinese Filipino community. It was just plainly Chinese community, aka the Sanglis. And they would live in these communities called Parian. So that's P-A-R-I-A-N, Parian. And aka yung mga Chinatowns natin, aka Binondo, that area, they're designated Chinese areas where hundreds and thousands, as in thousands talaga, thousands of Chinese would occupy. And during this area, or during this time, in the 1600s when the massacre happened, there were thousands talaga, like, they outnumbered by like 90% yung Spanish authorities. So that was one of the reasons, which we'll discuss later on, why the Spanish, you know, justified the massacre. So the Chinese menace, as the Spanish would, you know, consider them then, it was confirmed in around 1593, and this was when dito talaga nagkaroon ng origin yung parang that plot to massacre the Chinese. So nagkaroon ng incident no October 25, 1593, one of the governors ng Spanish, si Governor Gomez Perez de Dasmariñas, he prepared 4 galleys to attack the Moluccas, pero he had difficulty finding soldiers to man these galleys. So when the flagship was the only one left, he ordered that the Chinese contract workers who were entering the Philippines, 250 to be exact, were to be taken to man the flagship. So of course they were going to be paid naman. Hindi naman sila slaves. Pero forced pa rin sila to join this expedition to, you know, attack and conquer the Moluccas. So yun, na-force yung 250 Chinese na sumama dun sa expedition nila. But then, during their voyage, nagkaroon ng rebellion. Rebellion within that main flagship kung nasaan si Governor Gomez Dasmariñas. Which is weird nga. Like, parang why would you hire, like yung mga hindi mo kakilala, yun yung ipupunta mo dun sa flagship mo.
Yeah.
Yun nga. So parang nagkaroon ng rebellion then. And so yun, namatay yung governor and most of the 80-member Spanish crew. So doon talaga nang doon nag-start yung suspicions ng Spanish authorities to these Chinese noong 1593. And thereafter noong 1603, nagkaroon ng visit ng 3 Mandarins, and these 3 Mandarins parang judges sila from China. Well, they came to the Philippines, they introduced themselves to yung governor general, yung governors, yung authorities, the audiencia. They were like, we're judges, and kung sino man yung mga nakasurvive sa dun sa rebellion which killed your governor Dasmariñas, we would, you know, kami yung parang extradition in a way, like sila kami nang bahala ganun sa kanila.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're gonna be the ones to judge them. So, that was their main purpose. And at the same time, they were like, mayroon kaming narinig na story or news that mayroon particular mountain sa Cavite that had lots of gold and silver, and that people were able to mine, like, sobrang dami. As in, yung meron silang ginamit na measurement called tiles. What the Chinese said is that every year, nakakakuha sila ng 100,000 tiles of gold and 300,000 tiles of silver a year. So this mountain sa Cavite was able to yield such amounts of minerals and elements. So they wanted to, you know, exploit. There was like an open trade policy at that time. So parang they had this presumption that, or they claimed that everyone could just go and dig there, and that a significant number of Chinese have already taken a great quantity of these metals back to China.
Mm-hmm.
So parang sobrang weird, parang this visit by these 3 Mandarins, these 3 judges, like really roused the suspicion of yung mga Spanish authorities, and there would also be several other visits. Among Chinese, they think they were just bringing parang goods and other materials to the Philippines, but actually parang arms na yun. So parang within this period ng 1593 to 1603, there was a lot of parang shit going on. There was a lot of things going on behind the back sa Philippines, and well, yung Spanish, they were already noticing these things, and yeah, they were already planning. Both sides were planning, yeah. Now we're gonna move on to the main event, the massacre of 1603. Actually, medyo mahaba rin to na account eh. So, the massacre of 1603 will start with how it was prepared, how the Spanish, I guess, parang foresaw and interpreted yung mga subsequent actions ng mga Chinese and how they came to plot yung this massacre. So on December 18th, 1603, in 1603, when the incident was about to have ended, Governor Pedro de Acuña wrote the king of Spain, an account wherein he explained in retrospect his behavior during the whole event. He begins by saying that the arrival of the Mandarins had made him suspect a possible invasion from China. This was why his eventual moves, preventive and defensive in nature, were limited to the following. So one, to create space, he ordered the demolition of the houses in the Parian that was adjacent to the walls of the city. This, at the same time, corrected some of the wall's defects. Wow, okay. Like, parang justification and parang quick fix, like hitting two birds with one stone. And he asked the mayors of the district and the magistrates of the Parian to submit to him a list of immigrants under their jurisdiction and of the weapons in their possession. They were also asked to indicate whether these people were to be trusted or not. I think parang that kind of escalated things further. Like, I think yung perspective niya was like, if we burn down their houses, parang we would have like a strategic positioning. Ganun. Parang defensive, parang preventive in nature. Is what he said.
Yeah.
And I think, yung Chinese sa Philippines was like divided. Yung mga Chinese na parang more or less citizens na they live sa Philippines and they've been here. Mayroong mga Chinese na ganun and there's yung mga Chinese na immigrants lang. And more likely than not, yung mga immigrants yung the ones na parang who were just sent here to be, part of the war, part of the invasion, the quote-unquote invasion. So, nung sinira nila yung mga bahay na nandun sa Parian, they probably converted some of the, homegrown Chinese. Yung mga matagal na dito, na parang, homegrown they were Chinese. Probably like, parang ano lang sila, like memo lang sila, parang sa beginning, like parang, okay, whatever. I live here, so I like it here. I like the, I'm alright with the status quo. But then, sinunog yung bahay na, and they were like, no, we're not gonna have that, I'm joining. I'm joining the team. Mm-hmm. I'm joining the team. We're a team anti-Spanish. And we're gonna invade this land. And we're gonna make this one big Chinatown. So, that's a theory of mine. So, mayroon pang other preventive measures dito si Governor Acuña. He also carried out regular inspections of artisans and blacksmiths. And he hired other Chinese to build canals with the end of creating a moat around sa city. Governor Acuña also points out a distinction between the Chinese merchants who have settled for years in the Parian and their recent arrivals who were vagabonds and troublemakers who had nothing to lose and who could not return to China due to the crimes they had committed. So yeah, parang yung Philippines in a way becomes a haven for Chinese criminals. So Governor Acuña, hangs the blame of the succeeding events on these Chinese, yung mga vagabonds, yung mga makukulit, since they were the ones who paved the way for everything. The Chinese sources, they also echo some of Governor Acuña's positions. A question arises. Somehow, hindi nakakapag-agree fully yung mga Chinese and Spaniards to who really started yung massacre, yung uprising. According to Benavides, a bishop of Manila, when he sent a letter to the king, he said that the multitude of Chinese was so great, among them base and vicious men who spread the rumor, which is absolutely false, that the Spaniards were going to kill every one of them, which is why they provoked a rebellion on the night of the eve of Saint Francis. Yeah, and most of the Spanish sources here argue that nag-start talaga yung Chinese. And I think in a way the Chinese sources also agree to a point, because they were labeling the Chinese that were present in the Philippines as yung mga vagabond type. Like they were criminals.
Uh-huh.
Who are forbidden to step back to the land of China. So ito yung account ni Morga. So the evening of October 3, 1603, the uprising was scheduled to take place on the last day of November. So uprising to ng Chinese. But realizing that they were going to be discovered, the Sanglis moved it to the 3rd of October. On this day, at 11 p.m., about 2,000 men, or according to the Sangli, who was under torture, 40 captains to 150 men, began together in the Fort of Tondo. That night, Juan Bautista de Vera visits the governor to inform him of what was happening. Thinking that de Vera was in cahoots with them, the governor throws him into prison. The Chinese, noting of his absence, they replace de Vera with de Vera's godson. Possibly, Juan Bautista de Vera could very well be Chinese. Kasi when people were baptized, they're given, diba, like Spanish names.
Yeah, they're given new names.
So, as stated here, Christian Sangli. So, he's a Chinese Christian. So, si Juan Untay is a Christian Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese fly into action, burning some houses and then returning to their fort. The morning of October 4. So, this happened October 3 ng gabi.
Mm-hmm.
And at morning, no, October 4, the Sanglis of the Parian, that is yung mga old-timers na dun talaga sa Parian, and kilala ng mga Spaniards. So they were asked to enter the city. But the Spaniards refused to do so because they were doubting kung sino ba yung magiging victor sa conflict na to. So yung mga Parians, yung mga nandun na long before, were like, hindi kayo pwede pumasok. Dasmariñas leaves Binondo for Tondo to fortify himself in the church with 140 harquebusiers, and 1,500 Chinese rebels show up, and there's a fight to take over the church. 500 Chinese die, while the rest retreat to the fort. Dasmariñas pursues them and dies in the attempt. The day after, realizing that de Vera was not going to come, the rebels kill Untay and coerce the Parian residents into joining forces with them. The Spaniards likewise press the Parian residents to side with them. Wow!
Mm-hmm.
Sobrang ano naman yung Parian. Like, whoa, sino pipiliin ko, bro? So they're like, team them or team us? Team Spanish or team China?
Mm-hmm.
Who you gonna choose? So, merong iba, ibang Chinese, they were overcome by psychological stress. It's the psychological stress of everything naman. Like, the uprising, people dying, everything changing, destruction. So, that was October 5th. The next day, October 6th, there was another assault and renewed resistance. So, a Spaniard, with the help of Japanese corps, launches an unsuccessful offensive. An armada of pintados, which I assume are, you know, Visayan warriors, they suddenly make their way through the river and blast the Chinese lines with cannons. So they divide themselves into three and they penetrate the inland. One group makes for the Tingis of Pasig, another for Ayonbon, and the third and the most numerous for Laguna de Bay and the mountains of San Pablo and Batangas. On October 8th and the succeeding days, the Chinese abandon the city of Manila. The Spaniards are hot in their pursuit. it seems that the first two groups are easily annihilated, since nothing more is said of them. Well, the third group, starving and unarmed, leave a path of devastation. Luis de Velasco, with 70 of his men, is at their heels, killing many each day. Velasco perishes at the hands of the Chinese who set up port in San Pablo. Argensola adds that the native Filipinos, instead of siding with the Chinese, lent a hand in the massacre. So October 20, a new detachment of Spaniards, Japanese, and 1,500 natives of Pampanga and the Tagalog provinces is formed in Manila. They soon finish off all the Chinese who secured themselves in San Pablo and Batangas. The rebellion is quelled. October 22, Juan de Vera faces trial. In the succeeding days, other Chinese met the same fate. Only 300 are pardoned, but the rest are sent to the galleys. When they say sent to the galleys, what does that mean?
That the galleys were used as detention facilities rather than warships. So maybe it's like a converted ship and they were sent there. Perhaps. Yeah. So probably not hanged.
So yung Chinese sources naman are less detailed in describing the operations. Perhaps kasi konti lang yung nabuhay ng mga Chinese. It is thus more difficult to establish a clear parallelism between the two accounts, since they cite actions that are not mentioned in the Spanish sources. So one of the Chinese sources say that is that many of the Chinese were unarmed and a lot of them were killed, and the survivors fled to the Talun Mountain. Other accounts say that when the Spanish suffered momentary defeat, they tried to negotiate a truce, and the Chinese, thinking that this was some trick, killed the messengers, thus driving the Spanish chief to exasperation. He abandoned their mountain camp and retreated to the neighboring town, simultaneously setting up ambush parties in the surrounding areas. The Chinese rebels were starving and so decided to go down the mountain and plunder the town, only to be ambushed by the Spanish troops. So 25,000 Chinese perished in the massacre.
Damn.
According sa ano, sa Spanish accounts. However, sa Chinese accounts, it says that when the Chinese descended the Talun Mountain to attack the town, 10,000 of them were killed in an ambush, while others fled to the valleys and died there of starvation. So not really specifying yung 20,000, but probably a lesser number.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's basically it, yung Chinese massacre of 1603, yung 1639 Chinese massacre, as well as yung 1662. They're basically the same. You know, they're not basically the same, but yung reasons for the massacre are basically the same. It's, you know, politically motivated, of the Spanish trying to control yung population ng Chinese and the threat of rebellion and invasion, and that they felt that they needed to address that. But clearly, this was unjust. Unjust, yeah, to the Chinese community who were, you know, who were there. Who were just, yeah, there, yung Parian community.
Yeah, they were just caught in the middle of everything, you know. Essentially, they're just innocent bystanders. Maybe they're just trying to, you know, they're just trying to go through life. And then all of a sudden, it became like a race thing, you know? Like, You have to choose between one or the other, but what if you're just like some guy or some girl just trying to live your life peacefully? Like, I don't want to take part in any of that stuff, you know. Pero they get dragged into it and they're either forced to be part of one or the other, or, you know, commit suicide because they felt like they really had nowhere else to go, you know. It's between a rock and a hard place. And I don't know, I found it interesting that a lot of this stuff is like, well, basically the escalation was because of, you know, preemptive strikes. Like, a lot of the big events kind of came from preemptive strikes. I don't really have much to say on that front, but I think it's interesting when you look at the power dynamics, I guess, na parang when a group of people feels threatened, parang mapapush sila to take a preemptive strike, diba? Like, for example, like the first time when the Spanish burned the houses of the Chinese, they were feeling threatened because of the growing population of the Chinese, diba? And when the Chinese started hearing about rumors they were going to be massacred, you know, they felt prejudiced against, which is understandable. And yeah, I don't know, I guess it's just interesting. I guess yung like what we said kanina na, it's interesting to think about the thought process behind doing the things that we do, you know, especially something as big as massacring a group of people, like around 20,000 people, diba? So I don't know, I don't really have much to say on it. Do you have anything you want to say?
Yeah, I was trying to analyze yung concept of, you know, trying to massacre people. It's really like a detailed plan talaga. Because yeah, when you massacre people, you really plan to kill a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, if we relate it to, like, yung Maguindanao massacre, mm-hmm, I think they really plotted na parang these people who will be gathering in this area.
Yeah.
Kapatay namin to.
Yeah. And
so parang meron talagang resolve. Mm-hmm. Like, before it happens, there is a big resolve.
Yeah, like a decision was made. Yeah.
Yeah, this was gonna happen.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you brought up the Maguindanao massacre, because I was going to bring that up then in relation to what I said kanina na, you know, I feel like massacres are an exercise of power, and it's a power dynamic thing, because when the people who commit massacres are the ones who feel the most threatened. That's why, for example, in the Maguindanao massacre, I feel like there was the people who did that crime felt threatened by the people who were, you know, putting in their candidacies, right? That was what happened.
Yeah, I think so. Like, I'm pretty sure na a lot of people there were media.
Yeah.
And I think at the same time, yes, it was his wife who was filing his candidacy then.
Yeah, so I googled it just to give more accurate facts. Basically, they were filing a certificate of candidacy against the Ampatuan, and they were gunned down. And the reason why I bring that up is, you know, I think na the people who commit massacres, there's a certain element of feeling threatened by the people that they plan to kill. Parang yan, parang it's, I guess in their mind, it's like a quick fix. Na, you know, you're a problem and I'm gonna make you go away by basically killing you and the people like you. You know? And, I don't know, there's nothing more cowardly than eradicating a group of people because you feel threatened. It's a personal take. Parang, I don't know. I don't think
like,
there's
I find
any...
it funny rin, na parang,
yeah.
They thought that they can get away with it. Like,
yeah.
How can you massacre people and not know that it's you who did it?
Yeah. This is the ano pa rin, no? Maguindanao massacre.
Yeah.
And they still deny it, no? Even though there was like so much evidence. Yeah. I don't know. It's really a power move. Yung not power move in a positive way, yeah. Like a it's a grab for power to commit a massacre. Like yeah, yung sa Jabida in relation to the Jabida massacre. Again, it's not confirmed. Mostly because there've been a lot of I guess red tape, a lot of secrecy around, surrounding the whole thing. But assuming that the massacre did in fact take place, I believe that the main objective of it would be suppressing any information regarding the whole operation. But again, because the people that had them there felt threatened na they were either going to be exposed or the heads would be sanctioned or something like that. Again, there's a kind of threat and they chose to do a shortcut na, you know what, you're a problem and it's time for you to go away. And so everybody just chose to kill people. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. Basically, what we're trying to say is, if you're confronted with a decision of killing a group of people, odds are you feel threatened by that group of people. And maybe, you know, maybe, just maybe, there's a different way that whatever problem it is can be resolved without, you know, massacring a group of people.
If you know people, again, if you know people nah, really powerful, you know, and they have the means to kill people, and you know this person's angry, you know, maybe you should be wary about this person.
Yeah.
You know, baka may recent tantrum siya, you know, recently, publicly.
we're not naming in names, by the way.
If you know someone.
Yeah.
Ako, I'm not sure if I know anyone.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you know someone who has that power, yeah, it's something to think about.
Yeah.
If you wanna be with that guy.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just for me, committing massacres are like it's contradictory because for you to be able to commit a massacre, you would have to be very powerful. But at the same time, I feel like a lot of the motivations behind massacres is a feeling of powerlessness, you know? Parang you're scared of a certain group of people and you want them to go away because you feel threatened.
Exactly.
And, you know, parang maybe something to think about is parang, I don't know, just something to think about, I guess.
Oh yeah, I get that. You know, I get that. Na parang you're in a way weak. Mm-hmm. Na parang that's your only recourse.
Yeah.
You feel na that's your only recourse is to kill them.
Yeah. Yeah. I forgot to bring up pala na sorry, I forgot to bring up that my main source for the account on the Jabida massacre is the privileged speech of the late Senator Benigno Aquino Jr. So that's my main source for that and other news articles. To those who have been listening to our episodes, thank you so much. We hope you continue to support us and maybe share us with your friends, you know, so you guys can have more stuff to talk about. I don't know.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much for taking your time to listen to us. Probably our regular listeners, if we have that, and to our new listeners, you know, welcome to the club. And yung sa mga listeners na naka-discover sa amin from TPD, the Philippine Podcast Directory, welcome. And thank you for shouting us out, TPD. We love you guys. With that, we end our meeting. Thank you for joining us this week in learning more about Philippine culture and history. Let us hear from you and tell us how we can do better. Reach out to us on Twitter at Konyo History Club or at konyohistoryclub@gmail.com. If you're listening to us at Apple Podcasts, please follow us and rate our podcasts. We hope you come back next week for another meeting where we can embark on another journey towards the unknown. Again, I'm Ben, and that's Camille, and this has been the Konyo History Club. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.